So let's begin with Psalm 2. And as we read through these different passages, I want you to note two things. First of all, that Christ's mediatorial kingship is something that was given to him based upon his role as the Son, based upon his finished work in the covenant of grace. I also want you to notice, and this will come out especially in Psalms 2 and 110, that this kingship that Christ has is not only over the church, but it is over the nations, over the rulers of the earth as well. So keep that in mind as we read through these. So Psalm 2. Let's give our careful attention to God's word. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us." He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." So there we see that Christ is appointed king over his church, which is designated by Zion, by his holy hill. And we also see this address to the kings of the earth. And we see in verses 8 and 9, Christ being given the nations as his heritage and the ends of the earth as his possession. So we see that Christ's kingship is mediated through the church, but extends far beyond the borders of the church. Now turn with me to Psalm 110. And here we see very similar language. And again, you'll notice the mention of Zion, which indicates the church, the people of God. And you'll also notice a reference in verse 5 and 6 to the kings of the earth and the nations of this earth. "The Lord says to my Lord, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool.' The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head." I think the most striking thing about this psalm is that last verse. We have Christ presented as this great warrior king who basically destroys all who oppose him. And then we have this very human-like language that after this battle, he'll drink from the the brook and lift up his head. And again, I think it speaks to the fact that the mediatorial kingship was something that was awarded to Christ in his role as the God-man. Now over to the New Testament, Philippians 2. Philippians 2, I will read verses 5 through 11. And again, notice, this comes out very clearly here, that this kingship is something that was awarded to Christ on the basis of his finished work. And this comes out in verse 9, which begins with the word therefore. Meaning on the basis of what Christ has done, God is highly exalted. So let's begin reading in verse 5. Have this in mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was born in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. And then over to Hebrews chapter 1. And again, we see the same concept come through. You'll notice in verse 3 that it was after making purification for sins that Christ sits down at the right hand of the majesty, the place of honor, the place of eternal rule. And I'm going to read all the way through verse 13, because we'll see that the writer of Hebrews, being a skilled expositor, draws from all these different Old Testament passages, especially the Psalms. And verse 5, he quotes from Psalm 2, verse 7. And then verse 13, he quotes from Psalm 110, the two Psalms that we just read. Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 13. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? Or again, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son"? And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, "Let all God's angels worship him." Of the angels, he says, "He makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire." But of the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. But they will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. Like a robe, you will roll them up. Like a garment, they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will have no end. And to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Pretty clear language that Christ possesses this special kingship. So let's take some time to review. If you look on your outlines for this evening, under defining the doctrine, I felt like that maybe I didn't explain this clearly enough last time. So let's go through this again, and I made sure to define some terms here. So you'll see, as we define this title as the mediatorial king, as we saw in all of these passages, as a reward for Christ's work in the covenant of redemption, Jesus was awarded with a special kingship as the God-man. And so in this special kingship, Christ then mediates between God and man. And this is what I felt like maybe I didn't explain clearly enough, and that was this distinction between Christ's essential or ontological kingship and his economic kingship. So let's maybe define those terms a little bit. You'll notice there, that term ontological, that just comes right from the Merriam-Webster's dictionary. It relates to the essence or the nature of being. And that's the Greek word ontos, simply means being. So Christ has always been a king ontologically or essentially. Meaning before he took on flesh and became the God-man, he was a king. And we read of this, and we read that in John chapter 1 that he was with God in the beginning. He is called the King Eternal. So Christ was always king essentially. Is that clear? Please.
Good question.
Yes.
We said ontos. It has to do with the state of being.
Mm-hmm.
We in English relate that to the verb to be. How does that relate to his name? The name of God, he is I am.
I don't know. There may be, I am. But I am. I exist.
In the Greek, is it similar? Is it a variation? Derivation?
No, because the word that's used to translate Yahweh in the New Testament is simply Lord, Kyrios. So there's not really a. It doesn't carry over the etymological meaning of the word. And when we talk about Christ's mediatorial kingship, his kingship as the God-man, we're talking about his economic kingship. And I have some of the verses cited there that we just read that clearly, like, He is declared to be a son, and it comes out both in the passage in Philippians and in Hebrews that Christ is awarded this kingship on the basis of his work of redemption as the God-man. And that word economic, Stephen, I thought of you. I was trying to get to the root of this word this week, and I had a hard time because everything. It has to do with our economic system. But if you trace it back, it comes from the Greek word for house, oikos. Oikonomics is the original word. It has to do with the managing of a household. And so if you think about that, a household is a certain realm, and there's an order in that household. And I think the best way to explain it is in terms of a husband and wife. Men and women are said to be spiritual equals. Ontologically, men and women are equal. But in the economics of the household, God has set up an authority structure where men and women then carry out different roles. So the husband has authority, the wife is called to submit to her husband, the husband's called to love and cherish his wife and to lead her. And so while men and women are spiritual equals, in the economics of a household, there's a different order there. And I think that's the easiest way for us to understand it in Christ's kingship, that Christ is equal in power and glory with God the Father. He's always been a king, but as his role as the God-man, his role in the covenant of grace, he agreed to take on this sort of submissive role. And it really comes out in that passage in Philippians. So I'm going to turn back there again. And this creates a lot of confusion among Christians about whether Christ is indeed equal with God or not. Because we read in verse 6 that Christ, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. You get the language there. He didn't think it something to be held on to. He let go of it, so to speak. So we read this, and people ask, well, is Christ not equal with God? Well, the way to understand this is in terms of Christ's ontological kingship and his economic kingship. So in his economic kingship, his role as the God-man, he let go of that equality for a time when he took on flesh. Am I speaking clearly? Okay. I don't know that I'm going to go through all of this again. I want to push ahead a little bit, but look at the still under defining the doctrine. I stole this quote from another pastor. How did Christ secure his mediatorial kingship? Christ earned as man what he already possessed as God. I think that's a great articulation of it. Christ earned as man what he already possessed as God. Very briefly, under the doctrine as it is applied to society, Christ's mediatorial kingship, it's proclaimed by and mediated through the church, but it's not confined to the church. And we saw that in those passages in Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, where Christ is granted authority over Zion, over the church, but he's also granted this authority over rulers, nations, and the ends of the earth. And I have that. It's a fairly well-known quote by Abraham Kuyper where he says, "There is not one square inch of the entire creation about which Jesus Christ does not cry out, 'This is mine, this belongs to me.'" And the next hollow point there is where we really get into the difficulty. No Christian is going to deny the essential kingship of Jesus. It's fairly clear in the scriptures. But where the debates come in is to how his mediatorial kingship is carried out. And I gave you the example in parentheses there. Some even deny Christ's economic or mediatorial kingship. And I say that because of my experience in the CMA, where their doctrinal statement was that Christ is the coming king. And the implication is he's not a king now. And I shared with you some of the practical implications of that view, that there was very much a fear amongst the people. If Christ isn't king, then Satan is king. And so, Christ's kingship is then debated in the church's interaction with the culture, in the various millennial views, and in the nature of civil government and the Christian's role in that government. So I'll pause for any questions or comments. Yeah, page 2. I'm sorry.
You know that when the evil one is spoken of as the prince of the power of the air, he is not
seated. Yeah, but he is. I think that's in John. It's particularly seen in John's writings where Satan is referred to the prince of this world. And again, I think it's another area of misunderstanding and difficulty for us as Christians to really understand that. But I think we need to understand that as Satan is being, the use of the word world, it's used in different ways. And in that case, it's used of the moral system of evil that Satan is orchestrating and organizing evil in this world. But in the end, he is still subject to the kingship of Christ.
Certainly, even in the book of Job, there is permission granted. It wasn't something that Satan already possessed that had to be granted to him. And even in the terminology of prince, is subject to a king. Mm-hmm. The hierarchy is such that a king is obviously higher than a king. Authority in a worldly sense that a prince would have, he still has to be deferred to the king of the
day. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. And we'll get into that a little bit next week when we deal with the second petition in the Lord's Prayer. What we're asking for when we ask for the Lord's kingdom to come. Okay, thank you. Okay, page 2. I don't plan on going through the issues of debate, but any questions over these different millennial views, these eschatological views? So we emphasized last time that really it's only the last two of these, amillennialism and postmillennialism, that are biblically tenable views of how God's kingdom will come to its consummation. Questions or comments? And the reason I felt that it would be helpful to do this is because these views then have implications for how we view the mediatorial kingship of Christ. It is really, dispensational premillennialism is probably the most popular eschatological view in the church today. And I think it's really led to a misunderstanding of Christ's kingship and its application in this world. Okay, if there's no questions on those, I'm going to push forward to where we stopped last time. And that's the views pertaining to the nature and the authority of civil government. So again, here's where we get into the debates. How is this doctrine applied to society, to civil government? And so first you'll see the two kingdom view, that this is associated with Augustine. And the basic tenet of that view is that the church and state are separate entities. Both exist under the lordship of Christ, but they have separate authority, separate jurisdictions and means of operation. And it's actually kind of comical. I have this quote in here, the supposed quote from Luther, that better a competent Turk than an incompetent Christian. I actually just read an excerpt that someone posted on Facebook from some article that questions whether Luther actually even said that. That this might have been kind of a commentary on one of Luther's writings, but nevertheless, whether he said it or not, that sums up the view. we wouldn't want someone from the government coming in to our church service and starting to dictate what we can and can't do here. And likewise, as a pastor, I don't necessarily have the training and the skill to be a senator or a congressman. So, two, church and state, two separate entities, both are under the lordship of Christ, but with separate authority. Then there's the view that the civil government is inherently evil. We see this is very popular among many Baptists. It maintains that the Christian should have as little to do with civil government as possible, since they postulate that government is a man-made institution. I want to ask you guys, the Marble School, you lived in Virginia, which is a southern state. Did you run into this? Says Pennsylvania. Yes.
Your question.
I guess I'm just curious if you have come across this attitude or this view that the civil government is inherently evil.
We found it more in Alaska.
Well, prior to the moral majority in the 80s, this was the Baptist view of strength. You just didn't get involved and didn't talk about it or anything, and then Jerry Falwell started to come out. And there's something good to it, though, okay?
I think I remember you guys talking about, you knew a family in Alaska that had this view, and they took it to the point where they weren't going to pay taxes, or...
Well, they didn't, among other things, they didn't recognize the authority of the state to impose fishing game laws.
Okay. Which one? I do know exactly what you're saying, but I'm just saying
There were several. Now, to some extent, there was some self-serving. They sort of pick and choose of what they choose to obey or observe or respect and don't. You know, and it's a very slippery slope.
Part of my question is, I just wonder how much of this, the Baptists have a strong presence in the South. How much of this is kind of a leftover from the Civil War days, the secessionist type of mentality?
I think it's complicated. I mean, the truth is, there's an element of truth in all humanity. And yep. So I'm saying, okay, as a Christian, you're going to do okay. So there's so much for all of that. But then you can just say, Great Britain has a similar view.
Yeah, it is not. And it's interesting because Christopher Chelpka and I get together a couple times a month, and this is one of the things he wanted to talk about, because he wants to know, what do we believe about the mediatorial kingship? And we were talking this week how really it hasn't, I think sometimes we kind of form this caricature of it, like it's this clear, straightforward doctrine, when it's not. And even when you read a lot of in the Westminster Divines, there's not a consensus on how this doctrine should be applied to society. And yeah, Diane, I had the same reaction as you. There's an element of truth in all of these. So yeah, the Christian America view, this is, I think, fairly popular today. Proponents of this view hold that America was intended to be an explicitly Christian nation. While the Founding Fathers legislated against the establishment of one Christian denomination as the official state-sponsored church, they viewed the nation's law as inseparably linked to Christianity. So what are your thoughts on that one?
The Puritans had very much, there were those that had that view when they started out. I'm not saying that it's the right meaning. I mean, what is the...
Yeah. I'm trying to remember where was mentioned, one of the founding fathers clearly said that unless you, I'm paraphrasing here, but unless you start off with a Christian worldview and the application of what we would consider democracy, and I understand we're not a democracy, but the concept of democracy is flawed. So I think there has to be a mutual or a universal understanding that there are certain things that are inherent in law and some things that are inherent in mind. Otherwise, the majority of rules, you can legislate some of the things that we see currently affecting the country.
There has to be that objective king, that objective lawgiver for a republic and for democracy to work.
Things like murder of the unborn, things like same-sex marriage, stuff like that, unless you start off with that as, well, those are bad things. Why? Well, it's not because we take a vote and majority won. There, as you said, it's an objective standard. Absent that example.
So what's the difference between a theonomic view and the Easter? Yeah. Answer that in two sentences.
Yeah. With the Christian America view, I think the covenanters that came over, I think one of the areas that they were disappointed with was the fact that our founding documents did not mention Christ by name and acknowledge him as king. So I think that, you know, it's clear that our nation was founded upon Christian principles, but were we founded as a Christian nation? And again, you know, I don't know that I have the answer to that, but that was one of the criticisms that the covenanters had of our founding documents. Any other comments or questions that I won't be able to answer? Okay. National confessionalism. This view postulates that because Christ is King of nations, the nations then must be called to confess in their foundational documents the kingship of Christ over their nation and over all nations. And so this is really close to our distinctive. This is often associated with the practice of political dissent, in which Christians, for the sake of conscience, do not participate in the functions of civil government, voting, running for office, etc. So the wheels turn, trying to turn.
Because we confess that Christ is our King, should we not, by duty, implement that as far as possible to conscience? That's apparently the wrong answer in some circles, right?
So I just look at Christ's interaction with Pilate. Clearly, Christ wasn't running for public office, he wasn't voting, he wasn't doing any of those things. But there was a way in which he was interacting with the civil government at the time. He didn't just, hey, I don't respect you, I don't think you're this whole thing sinful, I don't recognize this authority, I'm the king. I mean, there was an extent to which he interacted, recognized, and there was a whole dialogue there. The kingdom is not of this world, what does that mean? And yet, it was certainly a respect for the order. Romans 13 also goes on to say that we are to pray for our rulers. So, I mean, there's an interaction there. I think the whole bit of running for or voting for, it comes down to the point at which, in the process of doing those things, when we call upon to check things that we know about Christian, that follow a Christian standard.
Brainless principle does not apply to government. I'm going to say it doesn't say thou shalt. It doesn't say thou shalt vote or not, mm-hmm. or whatever. Give to the king, let's do the king.
So again, I mean, it's not cut and dry. And
so what is the blue blood
here? His foot shaking.
I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to listen. But what are the arguments, the positions that are put forth that would support that, or is it, I guess, not universally but generally recognized as?
Well, one of the reasons for dissent is the idea of vow taking in terms of what is required to be to hold civil office. So if you swear that you're going to uphold the Constitution, and the Constitution does not make it so subservient to Christ and to, you know, to the Bible, then I think that was a big reason for, since the founding of the country until, you know, only what, like 50 years ago, our denomination practiced dissent, was because, you know, you couldn't run for public office because you would have to take a vow that, you know, you wouldn't be able to keep, saying that, you know, you basically treat the Constitution as,
or serving the military.
Yeah, and then also you can't vote because if you're not willing to do it, you shouldn't be, you know, willing to make someone else do it. You know, if you don't think it's lawful for you to do it, you shouldn't be voting for someone else to go and do the same thing.
The church pay taxes. For the people in the church pay taxes?
Yes. So I mean, they wouldn't say that necessarily, like, so that's where you're kind of getting into this distinction between, I don't know, giving one to Caesar, although
I think the last they don't pay that. They don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. Not pay taxes.
But see, I don't think they would say that the government is invalid in any way. They would just say it's, you know, it's wrong to be part of the government because of the vows that are, you know, that are required to be in it. So it's not necessarily invalid, even if it's inherently, you know, it's going to be sinful the way it's constructed. So I think there's a distinction. I mean,
would there still be a sense of, it's pretty easy to say that, you know, freedom would do that. But at the same time, like, I mean, they're taking every benefit of that.
Perhaps looking at it from a different perspective, just in my hierarchy of allegiances, that, and I throw this in this example, you have the centurion, who is clearly, you know, a member of the military and also part of the government at the time. And yet it was pretty clear in his mind that, yeah, he had people working for him, and when he spoke, people jumped. And yet he respected the authority Christ, and he was commended by Christ, having seen such faith in all of Israel. So you have an example there of someone who was part of the establishment, as it were, who was commended. But I think the thing for which he was commended was his faith and how he exercised that faith. That he understood that God is supreme, not Caesar, not someone else. Speculate, you know, how he exercised that. I think it's actually biblical, but I think by his statement, he's pretty clear on the fact that he gave Christ and that he, you know, recognized his ability to call dissent.
Yeah, and it is worth, I guess, worth noting that this practice of political dissent is no longer we no longer practice this as a right.
But I think it's also equally instructive to maybe ask why, if we did it one, and maybe to ask the question, what changed?
Yeah. Again, another complicated answer. I think a lot of it, you know, you have this transition. You have, you know, Puritans and Covenanters coming over from England and Scotland, and, you know, it's just a different world. They were, you know, they didn't want to see history repeat itself. You know, you have this separation clause where it's to prevent government from establishing a national denomination. And, you know, you read about what went on in England and Scotland, you see why. Because, you know, you had, you know, Erastianism, where the church is, or the governments in the church tell them what they can and can't do, and they're holding authority, and they're the ones that are appointing the pastors. And so you can understand that. But I think that in a way that, you know, you're comparing, they were comparing apples and oranges. And I think, again, you're looking at, Stephen, do you remember, when was that lifted, the political dissent?
I don't know. I want to say it was probably like the 50s, maybe, or even the 60s.
And you, I mean, I don't remember what the specific reasoning was. Was it just this general idea that this, we can't really justify, this is going beyond what the scriptures teach?
This is a question for how the government works, but I think you were able to take like conscientious objections when you took office, and I think that was part of it, going back to what I was talking about with the idea of taking a vow or oath. So you could say, you know, I think you could do something where you say, insofar as, you know, conscience allows, I swear to uphold the Constitution of the U.S. government. So you would be able to take an exception that says, you know, I'll do this so far as my conscience isn't violated. And so I think that was part of it. And the part of it is just, I think it's working out how kind of, I think for our denomination, how the covenants, you know, that were signed, you know, 350 years ago, how do they actually apply in a different country and a different time in terms of our interaction with civil government. I think there was something of a change on that front as well. So I think it's those two.
Thanks.
I think we actually paid for a lobbyist, maybe?
Yeah.
During one of
they got a hearing, committees. A hearing before the, what was the Senate committee?
Get a, basically a Christian amendment that would specifically put the Constitution subservient to Christ and say that we are, you know, we recognize the kingship of Christ in our country. It got close, but it never passed.
And Nathan and I were talking about oaths at one point, and I was telling him about what was called the explanatory oath, because you have the Revolutionary War. I mean, you look at the time period, the influx of Covenanters, and hey, they were eager to go to war against these people, and but they kind of felt like they were in a catch-22 because they didn't feel like they could really swear this oath. So there was this, it was called the explanatory oath, and it was basically an addition. I can't remember the wording, but it was insofar as, you know, I don't you know, violate any principles in God's word. And so then that enabled them to fight and to serve.
I know in some media, whether it be newspapers or online or whatever, there have been accounts of the government going after the church for what was being preached from the pulpit because it took on too much of the tone of something that was political. And really what it came down to, if you trace the thread, is it comes down to the IRS giving the church a tax-exempt status, but there are conditions behind that status, and one of them is you can't support any particular political candidate. You have to be a political matador. So there's an expectation by the government for being sort of the honest broker, as it were. Has there been a sentiment within the RP that in some way puts shackles on what you're able to say from the pulpit, or do you not even really feel like the response? other denominations have expressed that. You're getting into our business. That's why I can't say something negative or positive.
I haven't heard that brought up as an issue. The case that you're talking about, if I remember correctly, wasn't it a case where it was almost an endorsement of a particular candidate?
It comes up periodically. There's sort of a flare-up every once in a while.
It's usually applied only against conservatives, because when the liberals go preach in politicians in the South, and certain ethnic churches all the time. Nobody, how dare you say they do anything. So.
I think that's what the application was not even able to do.
Okay, let's plow on here. The theonomic view. This is the view that God's law, that's both the Old Testament and New Testament, is the only just standard on which society can be established and ruled. Because Jesus is king over all nations, efforts must be made towards the recognition and implementation of all of God's laws. And that's where that term theonomy comes from. Greek words for God and for law. So, this... anybody know any theonomists?
Yeah. The Chalcedon book that I mentioned last week, I'm not sure how far they carry it, though, to... I think they... It's more of a gradual... They're not going to do it by force. It's that so many... hearts get changed, that Christ eventually becomes, takes over his kingship role, and then God's law is applied in all areas of society.
Yeah, and I think that for that reason, this view is often associated with the post-millennial eschatological view. I guess my criticism of this view is it seems in a way... Judaizing might be a bit harsh, but there's this desire to bring back the laws of the Old Testament, which are clearly fulfilled and abrogated by Christ. Now, that's not to say many Reformed writers talk about the general equity of the law, meaning there are principles that we can learn from a law. And if Janine and I have been reading through the Old Testament, and you read all these things that seem so obscure and out of date, but in reality there's important principles behind there that would be very valuable for us, very valuable for our civil government.
David Reed, he talked about this when we were in Colorado. He said the problem with theonomy was that their view of the law for Moses was coming to Christ, and because it kind of didn't really embrace what Christ had done in because if you so which one of us would not be stoned? Okay,
right.
If you go to the standard of Christ, then too low the standard was the problem, because all of us have because we've broken the law, there would be no one left standing if the law were applied, the civil law were applied.
Yeah.
So
I would say that another thing that I think is problematic with their interpretation is they tend to focus on Israel as a nation and not Israel as basically the early church. Israel is the church before Christ, the people of God. And so when you read the laws, I think the most ready application for us when we see laws and particular punishments, I think there should be a tendency to think about what that means for the church, first of all. So, if you go through and you see what the punishments are that deserve death, and I think that there's definite application in how we do church discipline. How does God view this, the severity and necessary punishment of a particular sin, and what are the things that that we should be kind of most on guard against in the church?
Yeah, so if the penalty in the Old Testament law for being disobedient to your parents was stoning, you know, we could deduce that God takes that seriously, so the church should take it seriously as well. We would stone anyone, but you know, it's certainly an issue to be dealt with. Now, and this, I guess this is another question for you. Those of you who know theonomists, do you happen to know what their millennial view is? I'm just wondering if
Postmillennial.
Okay. And that would again fit with the golden age, that you know there's going to be this golden age of the church before. I think that, yeah, you just made a comment about that too. The Chalcedon group, mm-hmm. that there would be this gradual and that's Okay, finally, principled pluralism, that America was not intended to be a Christian nation. If it had been so, our founding documents would have proclaimed it. Our nation is a consciously pluralistic society in which the government's responsibility is to ensure the liberty and free practice of various religious creeds. So, again, that may sound, obviously we recognize that pluralism in our age is not a good thing. But again, there might be a small element of truth to this. I mean, we cannot compel belief. Not that we promote heresy and heretical views, but if someone's a Buddhist, I mean, what are we to do? I mean, we cannot compel them to change their beliefs. It's got to start from the inside out. All right, let's get to things that are certain. But first of all, the means through which the church is to act to transform society is the declaration and the living out of the gospel. I mean, this is how things are going to change. Change can only come, as hearts are regenerated. It's what we've been talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is emphasizing that it has to start in the heart. We have to be transformed. People have to come to a saving knowledge of Christ. And it's not until people begin to sanctify Christ as Lord in their hearts, it's not until that happens that our society will begin to be transformed. And so, again, as I've already stated, the state can't compel belief. The most that the state can do is enforce external conformity to its standards. And again, this is a subject of debate, especially among theonomists. External coercion cannot and does not lead to conversion. Again, it must be saving faith applied to the heart by the Spirit. And the third point there is something that we need, I think, as Christians to be more vocal about. The government's job is not to persecute us, not to limit us. The government's job is to allow Christianity to thrive and prosper. And again, we claim to be a pluralistic society, and so the suppression of Christianity is a violation of the terms of a pluralistic society. And we see this today, where every religion, every crazy belief is allowed, except the one true religion. And no constitution or individual can trump God's law. We're reminded of our status as aliens and strangers in this world. And again, we're not out of bounds in a pluralistic society when we proclaim Christ's rule over all of life. And again, we see the fallacy of a pluralistic society, because the neutrality that is supposed to exist does not exist. one belief or one dogma always rises to rule in a pluralistic society. And finally, most importantly, you know, Christ is Lord over all things. It's what we read in those two Psalms, in Philippians 2 and Hebrews, and all people, that includes nations and rulers, are called to recognize Him as King. So whether it's us as individuals, whether it's rulers in places of power, peoples of any nation, I mean, they are called to acknowledge Christ as their King. I'll conclude there on some things that are certain, and hopefully probably left you with more questions than have been answered. But you know, it's a lot to think about. It's Christ is indeed a King, but how that is worked out in our society is another story. No. Questions or comments?